I'm Dr. Ralph Ford, Chancellor of Penn State Barron, and you are listening to Barron Talks. My guest today is Emily Dobry, a graduate student who has been pretty active here on campus and contributed to a number of high-profile research projects here at Barron and at the Lake Erie Grape Research and Extension Center. And we're going to talk a whole lot about those today. In November, Emily, you and Dr. Mike Campbell, Distinguished Professor of Biology, published a paper that is getting some attention in the Journal of Plant Pathology, in which you identified a new pathogen that is damaging chestnut trees. And it is a fungus that had previously not been found here in the U.S., but we'll talk about that and a whole lot more. Welcome to the show, Emily.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, I'm going to go a little bit further into your background. You know, you earned a bachelor's degree in ecology and evolutionary biology in 2019, a master's in horticulture in 2021. Right now you're in the second year of your PhD program. You're currently enrolled in the Agricultural and Environmental Plant Sciences program at University Park. But your field work is here in Erie, Pennsylvania, and you still remain closely connected with Penn State Barron, where you started your Penn State path.
I do.
Well, let's get into it. Tell us, how did you end up at Penn State Barron to begin with?
Well, I had actually been working for many years at a Burger King franchisee locally, and I couldn't really move up in the business, and I kind of decided, oh, I need to go back to school. But the more I thought about it, the more I realized I didn't want to go to school for business. Mm-hmm. I wanted to go for sciences, and so my dad's actually a professor here, and
Professor of business as well.
Yes,
in the business
yes.
School. Yeah.
He's been here for over 20 years now. Mm-hmm. And so I think that kind of guided my desire to come to Penn State. He's loved being here and he's spoken so highly of it. I did do a few years or a few semesters when I was much younger.
Yep. So you first came here and then probably right after school and then decided it wasn't for you and you went out into the work world, so to speak. Well, then let's stick with that right now. So you went out, you were in quite the real world, and you found you had to come back to school. Mm-hmm. And it is not an atypical path, and it's a really good path. So how did that change your viewpoint or your study, and how did you approach school when you came back after working at Burger King for a number of years?
You know, I was actually really, I always think about how grateful I am that I waited. Because I didn't know what I wanted to do at 18, 19, 20.
Mm-hmm.
I really didn't have any clear idea of where life was going to take me or what I wanted to get out of it. And by the time I was 30, I had two kids, and I knew that what I wanted to do was do something that would be lasting for their futures. And that's kind of really what drove this love of working in the sciences. So I think waiting helped me figure out not only what I wanted to do, but take it more seriously.
So you had two children.
I did.
And you come back to school. This is a tremendous challenge. How did you manage that? You must have had to develop a system and been really disciplined about what you're doing.
Yes, I had a lot of help, thankfully. Their father was very helpful. My family was very helpful. Everybody was extremely supportive of me coming back to school. And I wouldn't have been able to do it without them.
Wow. And did you find that you kind of lost your academic edge, or did it come back quickly once you got into the classes?
I think it came back fairly quickly.
Okay. So mathematics, the writing, all of that stuff was there.
Mm-hmm.
So let's, we'll jump around. I want to talk about the work you're doing right now. You were working with Dr. Mike Campbell, studying, and he's been studying potatoes for a long time.
Yes.
And, they are an important food source. So what are you studying with him, and why do you find this subject so interesting?
So we're actually doing dormancy studies, and something that I think most people don't realize about potatoes, and I didn't even really think about it until I got into this, what you buy in the store is a dormant tuber. Mm-hmm. So it's asleep. Essentially, think about dormant trees. It's sleeping when you buy it, because if it starts to grow, once you start to get those meristems growing out, you get the eyes grow. You don't want it anymore. It doesn't taste the same. It doesn't have the same quality. And so we're studying dormancy to better understand some of the transitions that will let us know that it's exiting dormancy. So essentially, we're trying to find ways that will allow us to make sure that the tubers are on our shelves for longer, that we have a more stable food product.
So how do you get there? Is it how do you engineer or genetically change the potato, or are there other approaches? So you want to make it last longer, essentially, which is really important, mm-hmm. right? None of us like when we go into our pantry and we find our potatoes have sprouted and we know they start to get a little soft then, and, you know, you try to eat it, but you're probably not so happy that you did.
Or when you pick up that bag and you find out it's not a potato anymore, it's suddenly liquid and you don't really want that.
That's right, you've got liquid in it. We've all gone through this.
It's turning to vodka. So there are a number of ways. We are taking an approach that utilizes RNA sequencing. So that allows us to see what genes are being expressed during dormancy or which ones are not being expressed. And that kind of gives us an idea of what's active within the potato. But and that will hopefully allow us to identify genes that are important. There are other things that you could do, like developing transgenics, genetically engineered. Mm-hmm. That's not our track currently, but what we're looking at particularly is the use of sprout inhibitors, so things that prevent it from growing,
mm-hmm.
so potentially from exiting dormancy.
So what would do that? Is it a chemical or biological-based approach to it?
Yes, so there are lots of different methods out there. A lot of people use like clove oil or peppermint oil. Currently in the United States, the big one is CIPC, but we're trying to move away from that because it has long-lasting environmental effects that really aren't desirable.
Good, huh? Yeah.
So what we're working with is called 1,4-dimethylnaphthalene, or it's more commonly known as DMN.
Okay.
And that's just a natural sprout inhibitor that's actually found within potatoes.
And are there a particular type of potato that you're looking at, or is it a broad range?
We're looking at a broad range now, so we're trying to do everything from your table potatoes to chipping or French fry potatoes.
So I have to ask this question. Do you have a favorite potato that you like to eat? Do you like to even eat potatoes?
Oh,
doing all
I love
this
potatoes.
Research? All right, well, this is good because this means that you're studying something that you really like. So, but let's talk about your arrangement. So you're here in Erie, you're working, and a lot of people don't know, but Penn State, of course, has this great agricultural outreach, but we have something called the Lake Erie Grape Research Center that is in Northeast PA. I've been there a number of times, and, you know, it is, you're doing some great work there, not only on potatoes, but as the name implies, grapes. But you're in the PhD program at University Park. So how does this all work that you ended up here and that you're doing your studies here versus, say, in State College?
Well, so I kind of fell into that through the goodwill of Dr. Campbell, my advisor, and through Dr. Ivor Knight.
Mm-hmm.
They had wanted to, I think, kind of start the ball rolling on potentially supporting graduate research in the sciences up here at Behrend. And I had really wanted to stay here if possible. So they said, oh, here's our perfect opportunity. And that's really how it worked out. So all my coursework has to be down at University Park right now. We don't have the courses up here for it, which is fine. It was some commuting, but then I get to do my work here.
Yeah, we have a number, an increasing number, and this is part of our strategy here. And it's, I think, a really good one. We have, you know, opportunities to work the type of research you're doing, the work we do in here in Knowledge Park. It's all this idea of this open laboratory philosophy. And then, you know, as a graduate student, you don't have to be there every day at University mm-hmm. Park to go and study. So what do? You drive back and forth and spend a few days there and take classes? Is that the way it's working?
I did. I'm all done with my coursework now, thankfully, because it was pretty tiring. But yes, I would drive. I would commute down there for a few days every week and then commute back so I had some time with my kids.
Oh, okay. And did they have remote classes too? And did that work out for you during the pandemic, or how did that operate?
Yes, weirdly, COVID was beneficial for me in that it allowed me to stay here in Erie and do some coursework here so I didn't have to commute as much.
Well, it's kind of nice when you get past that point where your coursework is done and you can focus just on your research. Well, let's talk a little bit about some of the other areas because you've worked in some pretty high-profile projects here. You worked, I think, with Dr. Pam Silver as well on salt. Tell mm-hmm. us about the work you did on studying salt on roadways, and what did you find there?
So I think I started with Pam Silver in my freshman or sophomore year, working on road salt runoff. We have a big campus. We have a lot of sidewalks here. We have to keep those safe for our students. And she was really interested in looking at how far that salt runoff drifted away from the application site, so mm-hmm. when you put it on the sidewalks. So we started with a study where we went out and we took samples away from the sidewalk to see how far out that went, and it went surprisingly far and at very high levels. So that's important for us to know. I mean, if you've heard the saying, salt the earth, it was a way to destroy soil, right?
Yeah.
And so it's a big concern. You can see it around sidewalks all over Erie that the soil is essentially dead and it can't hold life because it's too salty.
Every year we have to replant the grass next to the sidewalks here, yeah.
Yep. And so that's really kind of what started it. And then we moved into looking at how that affects streams.
And what did you find?
So we worked with tapulids to start with, which are crane flies. They kind of look like those giant mosquitoes that fly around here. In the fall, everybody gets a little freaked out about mm-hmm. the giant mosquitoes, but they're just little leaf shredders in the water. They actually really help our water. And we found that they were not eating as much of the leaves when they were exposed to high stress salt, which means that we're not breaking down as much and getting that necessary carbon into the water.
Are there any recommendations that come out of it? I mean, one is it's a hard problem, right? So if you're the maintenance team here on campus or anywhere else, the easy answer is throw a little extra salt down because people will be safer and you avoid lawsuits and people getting hurt. And that's really important. So did you take it as far as coming up with recommendations to either alternatives for salt or better ways to apply? I mean, where did it lead to those sort of questions as well?
Not in my research personally. I know that that's something that she did look at in terms of using biochar to try and amend soil to hold on to the salt runoff a little bit so it wouldn't enter the waterways. But as far as I was concerned, no.
You were on the front end of the project, where you were, which was really important because you knew it was a problem. Mm-hmm. And there's no better place than here on campus, by the way, where we've got this great environmental laboratory where you could do that sort of research. So
well, and we have the streams around here. We have Glen Hill and then Trout Run and then Four Mile. So it allowed a lot of opportunity to really see how that was actually impacting real waterways.
Did you go out and test out all the waterways on campus?
So Dr. Silver actually did that. She did monitoring for quite some time in our water systems, and it wasn't great news for the waterways.
No, that's you know, and I've talked to her, of course, about the outcomes of this, and we're still trying to come up with solutions to reduce the amount of salt, but it's
a challenge.
It's a challenge. It's everywhere in our, you know, in every township, and it's heavily used.
Certainly not unique to Barron, and when you have to ensure the safety of students, there are certain things that you have to take priority.
No, it's a difficult problem for us. Well, let's switch to a different project that you worked on, and there's an infamous one, and I say infamous, I think it is here on campus because we love the name just sounds so interesting, Bloody Red Shrimp. So
yes.
Tell us about your work in looking into Bloody Red Shrimp.
Oh, that was a fun summer project. So that was headed by Dr. Matt Cruel mm-hmm. and Dr. Ivor Knight, and they were looking to try and identify ways to test ballast water. So in the bottom of a ship, they hold water to help keep them balanced. They wanted to be able to test for this invasive shrimp before it would enter potentially Lake Superior, where the shrimp has not yet been found.
Mm-hmm.
So they're trying to develop a testing system using environmental DNA or eDNA. And that's kind of where I got involved, was testing waters locally and learning how to identify the organism. And we kind of stumbled on it here in Erie.
Well, you stumbled on it, but I think if I'm not mistaken, you were the first group to identify this species in U.S. waters right here in Erie. Am I wrong on that?
I don't think we were the first in U.S. waters.
Okay.
I know it's been
about
identified.
About Lake Erie?
But in our area.
In
yes,
our area,
for sure.
Okay. Fair enough. And so you had a sense that they were out there.
Yes.
How did you, so walk us through. I think you spent some interesting times out there, in the middle of the night trying
yes.
to find them. I mean, are they nighttime creatures? Why would you do that versus just going out? How do you collect the samples?
They are nighttime creatures. They tend to hang out deeper in the water during the daytime, and then they'll come up towards the surface at night. And so you had to go out with this red lamp on your forehead down into the water and hope that you could see their flashing eyes, and then you would sample for it.
Ah, so you and your classmates were down there, or research mates, so to speak, in wader boots or something like this. How deep did you have to go into the water, or
We
what?
actually went, oh, I don't, it's that wall that runs out, the, is it a jetty? That
Yeah.
runs out between the lake and the bay, the channel there. So we were out on the wall and we would dip buckets in and pull them up and hope that we would find them in there, and we found lots. So
And did you know, or was it till you got back to the lab that you were sure that you had them there?
we were fairly confident because their eyes actually flash red when you shine that light on them, so it kind of is a giveaway, but they were officially identified by Dr. Gruelle once we got back to the lab.
And he did that via eDNA testing. Is that how you were?
He did it, we did it with DNA testing, but we also, he did it visually assessing morphological characteristics.
So why do we care about them? They're invasive, and I don't say that in a callous way, but I think listeners need to understand, are they a threat to our ecosystem here? What is the issue with having them in our waterways?
They are competitors for our natural native shrimp, and so they're out competing for food resources, and it's been some time, so I may be incorrect, but I don't think that they provide the same level of food resource, and they're not quite as desirable to our fish species that we have here as the native shrimp are. And so if you have it out competing and we have less and less of our native species, it can cause a problem.
And then the other things that eat those shrimp, and so it becomes probably a compounding problem. So where did they come from? So you said they came from ballast water, but I mean, what part of the world did they come from? Where did they trace back to?
I believe they came from the Baltic Sea.
Wow.
We have quite a few invasives from the Baltic, unfortunately, that came over on ballast water, so.
So how do you mitigate that problem?
You just have to test. I know that they're looking at using methods in the ballast that would kill life in there, so that you essentially have water that doesn't have anything living in it anymore, so you're not dumping potential living organisms. But I'm not entirely sure what all that involves.
And it's probably managing the ballast water so that it doesn't get dumped into the lake in the first place. And
Yes.
as we know, we've got Asian carp and the infamous goby, and I'm sure many other things that we could go on and on about that have been introduced that way, and it's a real issue. Let's switch back to the work that you're doing at the Lake Erie Grape Research Center. First, tell us a bit more about that center out there, and what is it, and what is the type of work that happens there?
So it's an ag research center, and it's mostly focused on grapes. So we have contracts with Welch's, so we have juice grapes, but we also have a lot of wine varieties out there. And it's really just focused on looking at pests, best growing practices for vineyards for grapes, but we also have a number of other things that we grow out there. We have HazCaps. I don't know if you've ever heard of a
I
HazCap.
have not heard of that.
I'm not entirely sure. It's a European, it's from Northern Europe. And it looks like a very long blueberry, but it kind of tastes like a blackberry. And we have some of those. We have blueberries. We have chestnuts out there. So there's a lot of agricultural research, and we work in collaboration with Cornell and University Park.
So how do the local farmers play into this? So do they come to you with problems and say, "We're seeing these issues. Can you help us figure it out?"
They do. They come to the center. They will bring in concerns about pests. They will come in for questions about which fertilizers to apply, which fungicides, etc. So they reach out to the Ag Center a lot. They hold something called a coffee talk pretty frequently, where they meet with the local growers so they can answer questions and kind of give guidance.
So you said something else there that caught my attention too, in that you look at different varieties of grapes. So are you trying to find those that can be better cultivated for the long term as well and introduce different varieties to the region? We know it's a huge part of our economy, but it's not really a great area generally for growing, say, red wine grapes. But I think they're really trying to do that more and more here.
They are. So I think a lot of what they're trying to focus on here is looking at what's going to be successful in our area and how they might respond to local pressures that we have, environmental pressures, pests that we have here that maybe aren't present elsewhere, fungi that we deal with, water resources, etc. But yeah, I think they're really looking at what's going to be successful in our area so that they can then inform growers.
Have you found the spotted lanternfly here in our region?
It has not been found in our region that I'm aware of. Flora Acevedo, Dr. Acevedo, would know more about that than I do, but as far as I'm aware, it's been found over in Ohio and New York, but not
Yeah,
here in
we've been
Erie yet.
fortunate so far. And for those who are listening, it's a highly invasive species. I think on the east side of the state, it is wreaking a tremendous amount of havoc. So you see the signs on the road to check your card when you're leaving certain areas and the like, and because they latch onto your car, I think, and move around.
Have you ever seen one in person?
I have not seen one. I've only seen pictures.
They're beautiful. I went to, I think it was Elizabethtown last year, and they're everywhere. They coat all the plants there. It's just overrun with these. They really take over. It is quite a problem.
But they are beautiful.
They are beautiful. They are very pretty insects.
Well, I remember as a kid seeing gypsy moth infestations, and it was stunning. And they're not pretty, by the way. They are not so nice looking, and it wasn't pleasant either. I remember being out in the woods in Massachusetts on vacation and seeing that, and it just was not all that nice to see. So when I hear about the spotted lanternfly, I think about that as well, and it's not a nice thing, so... Well, hopefully we can keep them out of our region, and knock on wood, so far we've been able to. Let's talk about an area where you have spent, I believe, a considerable amount of time, and that is looking at chestnut trees.
Yes.
So tell us a bit about just even the importance of chestnut trees. You know, they've had a tremendous decline in the United States. I'm not sure everyone's aware of that. And we'll talk about some of your research, but can you just set the table? Tell us about the importance of chestnut trees.
Sure. So chestnuts, they're closely related to oak and beech. They were here for upwards of 50 million years in our area in the United States. And they were incredibly important to our forest systems because they would produce large nut crops every single year. And they produced really tasty nuts. So they were very sweet. They were extremely palatable. They produced far more nuts than their oak relatives. So whereas oak only produces every 4 or 5 years a big nut crop, chestnut did every year. So it really supported a lot of life in our forest systems, particularly along the Appalachian Mountain Range. So they really dominated for millions of years up until about 100 years ago when we saw the introduction of another invasive pathogen.
Okay. So it came from settlers. And when you say pathogen, it's a fungus or something like
that? It was a fungus, yes.
Okay.
So it came from Japan and China. There were nurseries over there. It was a time in our country's history where we were really interested in having the exotic species in our gardens. And so we were bringing in a lot from all over the world. And unfortunately, we introduced chestnuts that had this disease. And they could handle it, but the American chestnut, which had been largely isolated throughout its existence, couldn't. It didn't have any kind of natural resistance. And it really just... absolutely devastated the American chestnut.
For people who are looking for them, right, so to identify them, they have a very distinctive looking nut, though, don't they?
They do, but the challenge right now is that we've had nearly, almost 100 years of hybridizing with Asian species, and so a lot of times you may think that you have an American, but chances are pretty good you have a hybrid
version. Have some sort of hybrid. And did that hybrid make it, frankly, so that they could survive here? Is that it?
It did help, yes. It increased the resistance to the disease because the Asian species were more resistant.
But is it that the Asian species are not as good as the American in terms of the, you know, the fruit and everything that you talked about?
They're not as tasty. Yep. The size is much, much different. If you were to look at a Chinese chestnut, they're massive in comparison to an American chestnut. So if you're looking at that as a food resource in our forest systems, the organisms that used to rely on this tiny little nut can't use that big one.
Okay.
And the trees are typically shorter for the Asian species, so we don't have that canopy growth, which is necessary for the American chestnuts here to be competitive.
So can you find them, you know, if you go into our forests in our region here? They are out there, some of the American chestnut trees?
Yeah. So they're considered functionally extinct, which means that they're still in existence, but they are having a hard time reproducing, essentially. They're out there, but they can't reproduce and keep that species going. And that's what makes them functionally extinct, is we're not really seeing new chestnuts being established. And that's because they have to reach the canopy. That's why that height is so important. So you can find them, but they're
you
few
can
and far
find
between.
Them. Well, so, but your research is to try to restore them and bring them back. Is that a fair assessment, or what are you looking at?
My research was actually focused on another pathogen that has become a new concern for chestnuts, and I really wanted to look at what that could potentially mean to the restoration efforts, not that I was necessarily involved in the restoration itself, but looking at how this pathogen could affect the work that they're doing.
Okay. So tell us, I think you've had some pretty significant results. Don't be modest here. Tell us what you found.
So we were looking at a pathogen called Pneumoniopsis castanii, which is quite the mouthful. It's also commonly known as chestnut brown rot.
Okay. Say it again. What was it?
Chestnut brown rot?
Yeah.
Yes.
What was the full name?
Pneumoniopsis castanii or Pneumoniopsis smith-ogilvii.
Okay.
Yeah, those are fun to say.
They're fun to say. I'm not even going to try.
But it's been a big problem over in Europe and Australia where it's caused a lot of crop loss because they still have competitive chestnut industries there where they can grow and sell chestnut nuts. But this is rotting the product. And we recently identified it here in the U.S. It was actually Dr. Sakalidis up in Michigan who identified it first, but we identified it around the same time here in Erie.
Okay.
And so we were really interested in what that's going to mean for the hybridization efforts and for the transgenics, because those were your nuts are your next generation for chestnuts. So if this is a nut rot pathogen here in the U.S., what's that going to mean?
So then your goal is to help the trees adapt, or is it to keep the pathogen out? And what's the thought process as to how you mitigate it?
So our goal here wasn't to look at mitigation at all. It was really because nobody had studied it in the U.S. yet, and nobody knew what it was going to do to the American chestnut or our hybrids, our Chinese species that we widely grow here. We wanted to look at how it was going to affect the species that are common in the United States.
I see.
And understand what it would mean to them.
And is this the subject of your PhD thesis?
No, that was part of my master's thesis.
Okay.
Yes.
So now tell us what you're doing in your PhD work.
That's working with the potatoes and
dormancy. That's the potatoes work. Okay.
Yes.
So how far along are you in your studies? Are you writing your thesis as we speak?
For my PhD? No, not yet.
Not yet.
I should get on that.
Well, I'm not trying to pressure you. I know there always is a lot of pressure to do so, but you have to be getting close to that point here if you've finished all your coursework, right?
Well, luckily my coursework was kind of the same thing that it was for my master's, so I knocked that out of the way pretty easily. But for my PhD, we will be finishing sequencing our second year of data, and that's really kind of when we're going to start writing this up and
getting the results out there. Yeah, you need some publications and So, you know, what is your plan after you graduate? You know, is it to go into higher education, research, teaching, industry? What's your plan?
I'm not really sure. I really enjoy the work at the Ag Extension. I love working with people and being able to do that outreach. I've really been enjoying doing what teaching I have done, or the TAing in some cases. But I really enjoy that too. So my choices are endless, I think.
Well, you've got some time to think about it.
I do.
You've got a long life ahead of you, so you can do many different things. You know, you don't have to have it all figured out. Well, we're coming to the close of our discussion here today. Is there anything else you'd like to add about your experiences here at Barron and at Penn State?
I think that what I would like to add is that Barron has really been my home. There's a reason I came here for my undergraduate. There's a reason I wanted to stay here for my graduate research. I love this campus. It's beautiful. The people here are so incredibly supportive. And I think it's been my home. I feel incredibly honored to be a part of ongoing research and promoting this university.
Well, we're honored to have you here, and you've really been involved in some high-impact projects, and you've made a contribution to them. And I'll just add that I think, you know, you exemplify what we see here in the Barron culture, which is a really engaged community, a focus on our students, but I think really unique in not only combining that great teaching, but research as well. And you're probably one of the greatest examples we have of somebody who has lived that. So thank you so much. My guest today has been Emily Dobry, a graduate student here at Penn State University and working here at Penn State Barron. My name is Dr. Ralph Ford. Been listening to Barron Talks.